Today on Wings, think computer games are just a boy's world? Think again. Brenda Laurel deeply transformed the gaming and computer worlds from their early days, and she got her start in theater. She advocates for diversity and inclusiveness in video games, and she pioneered virtual reality. Her PhD dissertation, published in 1986, was titled Toward the Design of a Computer-Based Interactive Fantasy System, and it formed the basis of her 1993 book, Computers as Theater. Brenda told her life story to Suki Wessling, host of the podcast The Babblery, and Suki shared part of that longer interview with Wings.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
What I hope we can do as culture makers, you know, is to shape our culture in such a way that lifts up compassion. And that's a tough call. It's always harder to do the good thing.
This is Suki Wessling, host of The Babblery at BABBLERY.com. You're listening to my interview with groundbreaking game interaction designer Brenda Laurel. Laurel is an unlikely tech entrepreneur. She has a PhD in theater. But that unlikely pairing led to a perspective that changed the early video game industry for the better, especially for girls.
While I was studying for my PhD generals in 1975, I met a fella who had been a friend of my boyfriend in high school named Joe Miller. He passed away about 10 years ago. He was, you know, he turned out to be just, you know, head of Sega and all kinds of stuff. Very important guy in the computer game business. In 1975, he was working at Battelle Memorial Institute, which is a research lab in Columbus, and he was the computer guy. And I remember he took me to his studio, his lab, to show me what he was working on, and these images from outer space were painting themselves slowly across the screen. And I literally fell to my knees and said, I don't know what this is, but I want a piece of it. This is amazing. You know, I had this, oh my God, moment. Well, a year later, he and his colleague, John Powers, left Battelle to start a little computer game company in 1976 in Columbus, Ohio. And it was a little box with 2K of RAM, 2K of RAM, that connected to your computer. You could use an alphanumeric keyboard. The cool thing was it was loaded from cassette tape, so you could synchronize audio, which was fun. But the unfortunate thing about 2K loaded from cassette tape is that a player couldn't make a choice that made a difference. You had to have converging nodes at the end of a segment of code. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got passionate about interaction design. Mainly, how do we design things that allow people to take action in a virtual environment or a computer game that has real consequences, mm-hmm. that changes the world, that changes the plot? And I came to understand that when somebody plays a computer game, they're really engaged in time-displaced collaboration with the designer, and that's the designer's job to design a world in which that person is predisposed to make dramatically interesting choices. So at the end of a, you know, day of play, you can tell a story about what happened that's a really interesting story. That's so important. It's so canonical, I think, to making a good computer game, a good VR experience, anything interactive, that if you can construct that dramatically interesting story when you've gone through it, it's a success. And ideally, you should be able to construct an entirely different story going through that same world multiple times. Mm-hmm. So that became sort of the thing I was about in the game business and later in the VR business.
Brenda Laurel found her calling in the nascent game industry, where she applied her theater training to interactive entertainment.
at the time, we're talking early to mid-70s, there was a big trend in the theater for audience interaction, hair, Dionysus in 69. These things were on Broadway. Mm-hmm. There were people running around doing that kind of work. And I had worked with an actor friend to write a kind of an interactive scenario of a play about Robin Hood. And we staged it around the lake at the center of the campus. And the kids would follow the minstrel along to these various places, and a scene would unfold. But the rule that we had with the actors and the team was, whatever the kids said, you needed to take it in, make it matter in the plot. And that was just amazing. So the computer game stuff a year later, I mean, I already had my feet wet in this notion of interactivity and live theater. And the idea of being able to do it in a fantasy world was big.
It seems like one of the limitations that you came up against early on was just the technical limitations, just the RAM.
Yeah. Yeah. When we got 16K, we thought we made jokes like, we're going to do War and Peace, man, you know. So. On an 1802 processor.
So after that game, what was your path?
The little company that my friends had started was superseded by an upstart in California called Atari. And so our company was going bankrupt and the boys were all moving to California. So I'd never been to California. I said, okay, I'll go. There are jobs at Atari. And when I started at Atari, I was manager of educational software or something, even though it was a game company. I ended up being the director of strategy and production for the Atari 800 computer. And that's how I started to get into trouble at Atari, because the president of the corporation wanted me to spend all my budget porting computer games from the game machine to the personal computer. And one day I went into the office of the president of the division, the computer division, and I said, look, this is stupid. These games don't run as well, for one thing. For another thing, you have a new product that you're trying to differentiate from your game machine. Let me use your chalkboard and show you all the things we could be doing. Personal finance, right? Personal well-being, in addition to games, word processing, a spreadsheet. You know, there are all these opportunity spaces that we're not getting into, and it's going to kill this product. And he said to me, your salary's doubled and you report to me.
Here you are. You come to California and suddenly you're managing. And I'm guessing, just projecting here, that it was mostly men. What was that experience like?
It was funny. I have a story I will tell that has a bleep in it. I was chairing a meeting at one point with heads of engineering and marketing and stuff for some of the products we were working on. And they were all men. And I'm sitting at a long table and they're all chatting away and kind of ignoring me. And finally I said, you know, hey, guys, we got a f***ing meeting to run here. And dropping the F-bomb got their attention. They never gave me a hard time again. So there was a sort of rowdy male impersonation period that I went through, you know, with these guys. Mm-hmm. That didn't continue to be necessary, but it was an interesting insight for me.
As a woman in a man's industry, Brenda Laurel was acutely aware of her gender. But instead of being held back by that, she leaned into her fascination with the difference between the ways women and men play and lead. We join her now as she founds and then moves past the conference that now defines the gaming industry.
I have a pretend brother. His name is Chuck. He has a company called Alter Ego. He's a stoner. He's shorter than I am. And when I was hosting the Computer Game Developers Conference, which I co-founded, one time I called and said, you know, I'm sick. My brother's going to take my place. So I got up in magnificent drag, including a really finely done beard, army jacket, you know, kind of crass guy. And all you have to do to impersonate a male is to narrow your pitch range. So right now I could be taken for a male without even lowering the volume because I'm not going like this. right. So anyway, Chuck showed up and people that I knew well could not see that it was me.
What?
From a foot away. It was just great. It was really fun. And then I ran into Dan Button, who did Seven Cities of Gold and Mule, famous computer game designer. And Dan was in drag. And I'm joking. And I'm saying, oh, Dan, let's dance. And he said, my name is Danielle now. I am post-op. And I freaked out and ran back up to my room, took off all the crepe hair, put on some rhinestone earrings, came back down, you know. I felt awful about it. Danielle stayed a great friend of mine until she passed away, and she really inspired a lot of the work that I did with Purple Moon, but that's another story.
What would you say that emotion was that made you go back and dress in a more feminine way?
I guess because one could be thought to be making fun of somebody. And here's this woman who's gone through major surgery and hormones and really done the job. And here I am screwing around with crepe hair. And I felt cheap, and I felt like I could be seen as being, you know, making fun of her, making fun of cross-dressing, making fun of queer people. And I sure didn't want to be that guy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, you know, you got really deeply involved. You said you started the conference. Can you talk a little bit about when you started in computer games, there was no industry really. So, what does it take to build up an industry like that? A conference is obviously one of them, one part.
Yeah, I think at the first computer game developers conference, it was Chris Crawford and me and John Powers and some other folks were at that first one. And there were 50 people. And these were guys who were working at Atari. There really weren't many competitors to Atari until Activision showed up a few years later. A lot of us were just nerds, you know. But we had the idea that we had information we could exchange. We'd have great conversations. Let's have a conference. And it started really small. Chris, without our knowledge, sold the conference about 4 years into some conglomerate. And it got changed to the Game Developers Conference, which now has like, I don't know, 20,000 people come. Mm-hmm. Last time I went, I just couldn't handle it. It's kind of been taken over by marketing dweebs and finance people. But going back to your question, the way you make an industry out of it is you make a culture out of it. And you grab onto stuff that already exists in the culture and extend it. So, hence, the somewhat dubious practice of computer game companies licensing, you know, Hollywood movies and making games based on them. Now, like 40 years later, I look back and it's so ironic that I'm seeing movies based on computer games. It's just turned itself inside out.
Yeah.
Back in the game world, when I started a company to do games for little girls, we interviewed 1,000 little girls all over this country to understand play. Because in those days, that we started that company in 1997, girls weren't using computers. And one of the reasons for doing the research with girls was to figure out what it would take to get their hands on a computer and feel secure and safe about it without having this fear that they were going to break it or that they were doing something against gender norms because it was tech.
Yeah.
Because we knew it would make a huge difference in their individual and our collective futures. So that's really what stimulated me to go do that. That plus, you know, after 17 years of working with boy games, for boys, violent games, you know, stupid games, I really wanted to do. I finally got it together to say, okay, I'm in a spot. I can ask for the funding. We're going to make this happen. And we did.
On Wings, you're listening to Brenda Laurel, American video game designer, interaction designer, and researcher, speaking with Suki Westling, host of the podcast series, The Babblery.
So that was nice.
Brenda Laurel co-founded the very first company that produced games for girls, Purple Moon. They soon realized that in order to design for girls, they had to figure out what girls might actually want.
Backing up to the situation before you started the company, you're working in an industry that, you know, you just described in this way that's different from the industry now, because there are games for boys that are no longer like that. There's like a gender neutral section in the middle.
Yeah. Well, all the multiplayer games like World of Warcraft, you know, the Rivendell stuff. There's a bunch of gender inclusive work being done, especially in the multiplayer space, but also in the independent game design space. In recent years, we've seen that I would guess the majority of the most successful games have been authored by gender nonconforming people.
Interesting. So, but let's go back to where you were with this hyper masculine environment. And was it generally accepted that these games were just for boys and that girls were a lost cause because they weren't using computers?
That's almost true. There were some exceptions. Women really enjoyed narrative adventure games. So Roberta Williams' work way back in the day. Girls liked Pac-Man a lot. I had a male engineer once tell me that that was because it was a game about an eating disorder. And I had to work really hard not to punch this guy. And girls, big insight for me was that girls tended to like, in the arcade days, first-person driving games.
Hmm.
And what turned out to be important is the first-person-ness, the first-person view, because generally speaking, females do less well than males at mental rotation under time pressure. Well, if you remember the old games, they're most of them side-scrollers. So already a female player has to do a mental rotation to follow the course of the game, plus a translation from the keyboard or the mouse to the plane of the screen. You're screwed. You can't win if you're, quote, normal in that way. And of course, we're talking about, you know, bell curves. But in a first-person game, you got the same edge as anybody else. And by the way, girls can do mental rotation as well as boys when there's no time pressure.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. It's a brain-based difference that isn't just cultural. There aren't many of them, but that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there were some games that girls played, but mostly this was a culture built by men, by young men, for young men, sold in places where young men shopped, period.
Yeah.
You know?
There's been a lot of exploration of the history of Radio Shack and its importance in the early computer industry, because so many of the kids, almost all of them boys, because it was a very girl-unfriendly space, were brought into technology through Radio Shack.
Yeah. I think a big change that happened in the game industry that helped it become more inclusive in a funny way is that the retail spaces changed. So when you started seeing stuff at Target or Kmart or Fry's even, you remember Fry's?
I loved Fry's.
I miss Fry's so much. Anyway, yeah, I think the change in retail spaces broadened the audience a little bit. And it certainly made it possible to think about creating and succeeding in selling stuff that wasn't just for boys.
Mm-hmm. You said you started with research. What are some of the big takeaways that you had about the research and what girls might enjoy in games that was different?
Well, you know, at first we thought we're just going to ask girls, you know, what kind of games would you like to play, until we realized they didn't have any experience with computer games. Most of them hadn't played at all. They watched their brothers play. So the real question was, how do girls and boys maybe play differently, period, you know, in terms of play. So the mental rotation finding was a big one. Probably the most illuminating thing that we discovered is, and was well known probably to sociologists, is the differences in how girls and boys in U.S. culture tended to manage their social networks. So boys, and again, I'm making generalizations here that aren't universally true. Boys tend to do direct competition. I can kick your ass. I can throw this ball farther. And then it's over. It may change who's popular. You know, if I'm the star quarterback and my best friend is going to get elevated socially along with me. So there's a kind of an org chart-like network for boys. For girls, it is really different. The tools that tend to be used are affiliation and exclusion, so that it's not what level of a hierarchy you're in. It's how many friends you have and which friends you have, and to increase your social status, you can either affiliate with a new friend or you can cause an exclusion to happen among friends that are currently there. This probably sounds familiar to any woman listening to this program.
It probably
we do this.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when we're little, we play in groups of three girls and we take turns excluding one. That's how we roll.
I feel like you just sort of described why I was a child without that many friends.
Oh, me too. But, you know, they're
good at this stuff. You know,
it's just I'm not either. I can remember it so well. And, you know, I see it when I give talks about this, women light up and they'll say, I'm 60 and this is still going on, you know, in my life. Mm-hmm. So there is something about that. And if you look at pygmy chimps, they do the same thing. When they're hanging out in same-sex groups, they use affiliation and exclusion, and they do it by grooming or holding your baby or, you know, whatever it is. It's the same behavior. I can remember I had all these primate books in my office, and whenever the press was around, the marketing guys would come running in and pull all the primate stuff off the shelves because they were afraid that we would offend Christian buyers.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Sum up your feeling of what happened when you created your company and brought girls into it. Did you feel at the end like you had done something, moved something in any direction?
Absolutely. I felt, and I still feel it. I still get email from these women who are now 35 or 30 who played my games and say, you changed my life, because the games were called Friendship Adventures and they had to do with issues like the one we just discussed and in terms of both social status and self-esteem. So I felt very proud of the games, and so did all the people, mostly women, who worked for me in that situation and with me. My collaborator, Christy Rosendahl, was the co-founder of that company, and she did all the web work back when you had to roll your own. There were no tools, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was very proud of it. At the same time, Paul Allen, who had funded the company through Interval Research, was on the board. He decided that the grass was greener on the internet side of the fence. So they pulled their investment from the company. Just like I had 80 people to give a paycheck to the next day.
Wow.
And they just threw the big red switch. And we had been negotiating with Mattel to invest, even though Barbie is something I hate more than I can say, because of her, you know, instantiation of hegemonic values. But when they pulled the rug out from under us, we were in the process of shipping our eighth game. Our website, you know, in the first year was beating Disney in terms of hits and dwell time. But this fickle behavior on the part of a millionaire, I just was devastated. I was blown away. I got a half year's pay. And I spent that year writing a very angry book, and then I burned it. And then I wrote a very good book called Utopian Entrepreneur, which I think of as my best book, even though people talk about Computers as Theater as an important book. Utopian Entrepreneur was really the lessons I took away about business, about how you can have goals to do social good and still manage to make a success of it. That was a very thoughtful year. And at the end of that year was when I was asked by Andy Davidson to come revamp the graduate media program at Art Center. Mm-hmm. And that changed my trajectory for the next 15 years. I was an academic until I retired. What we can do, what I hope we can do, is begin as and continue as culture makers, you know, as culture workers, to shape our culture in such a way through our efforts that lifts up compassion. You know, there's more than just fight or flight that gets us excited. Helping gets us excited. Loving gets us excited. Watching somebody's fortune turn from awful to good gets us excited. Read Shakespeare, you know. And it's up to us as culture workers, you, me, to create conditions in which we have alternatives to that kind of thinking that are compelling enough to draw people in. And that's a tough call. It's always harder to do the good thing.
I do, I want to.
It's always harder. And my advice to anybody who complains about it is suck it up. It's our job.
Tell your girls a story, I won't tell you a lie. Anything you want, you can do it just fine. Come on. Come on and rock the world. If they tell you you can't do it, you just turn it up and play like a girl.
Thanks to Brenda Laurel for the fun and inspiring conversation. You can find links to her work at BABBLERY.com. The song Where the Magic Happens is by Stevia Spear on Bandcamp. Play Like a Girl is by June and Jean Millington, courtesy of the freemusicarchive.org.
Two, three, four, hey, what's the sound? Kick your engines running, we're messing around. Come on. Come on and rock the world. If they tell you you can't do it, you just turn it up and play like a girl. Four little fish swimming under the sea.
You've been listening to The Babblery. The Babblery is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California. To access more episodes, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform or visit BABBLERY.com.
Wings thanks Suki Westling and The Babblery for use of this audio. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. You can find past Wings shows through the website wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.